Well, I don't know if you guys are clapping because of Ben Shapiro is going to come out in a few minutes, or because I'm going to be graduating in like a month and you don't have to see my face here again. Fellow Patriots, LMU Lions, and Freedom Advocates, I want to welcome you to Young America's Foundation's Fred Allen Lecture Series. I also want to welcome those watching online. Hi, Mom. My name is Adam Duarte, founder and chairman of Young Americans for Freedom at LMU. I also want to thank the numerous YAF chapters who are here tonight. Can we hear a shout from all the YAF chapters here tonight? I want to thank Young America's Foundation for their tireless support and consultation. I feel like P.T. Barnum, because of all the hoops we've had to jump through this semester. It's been a circus. I may be biased, but I want to thank the most hardworking group of people on our LMU YAPI board. Their hard work and dedication are what made this event possible. Our YAF chapter also wants to thank the generous supporters like Fred Allen for sponsoring this speech, and Denny Schneider for donating to our chapter directly, and the numerous other supporters. I wanted to thank Associated Students of LMU for approving the funds to make sure that all of us are safe tonight. I want to thank Student Life Development and Katie Stiles for working with our organization directly. I want to thank all our friends and all our families who have taken our late night calls and listened to us vent about the frustrations that come up with putting an event like this, and for taking the time off from their busy day jobs to support the hard work that we put in our campus. Last but not least, I want to thank God, because without him, we would not be able to enjoy these freedoms that we have in this wonderful nation. So if you're here tonight, you've definitely heard of Young Americans for Freedom at LMU. We are the premier conservative student organization. We are dedicated to advocating for individual freedom, a strong national defense, free enterprise, traditional American values, and the ideals enshrined in our Sharon statement. Chances are you've been triggered by some of our on-campus activities. One of our most popular displays may have caught your attention, our mock Berlin Wall and Palm Walk. Or you may have been a little offended by our infamous Covfefe Wars with Andrew Klavan and the execrable Michael J. Knowles. We have given you plenty of reason to come check us out, and tonight we give you one more. We would ask that everyone remain respectful, and if you disagree with the content of tonight's speech or anything else, please wait for the Q&A session. Now, some may refer to tonight's speaker as the Hebrew Hammer, or as God's chosen debater. But Ben Shapiro is editor-in-chief of thedailywire.com, host of The Ben Shapiro Show, the top conservative podcast in the nation, and syndicated radio show heard on more than 150 stations nationwide, including 8 of the top 10 markets, and a leading conservative speaker on college campuses. Consistently defending free speech and open debate, Shapiro is the author of 8 books, including the number 1 New York Times bestseller, The Right Side of History, How Reason and Moral Purpose Made the West Great. Please clap. Shapiro is also a nationally syndicated columnist since the age of 17, and a graduate of UCLA and Harvard Law School. The Washington Post calls Shapiro a foe of extraordinary polemical agility, and the New York Times calls him the cool kid's philosopher. Rush Limbaugh says Shapiro isn't just content to have people be dazzled by his brilliance. He actually goes out, confronts, and tries to persuade, mobilize, and motivate people. Glenn Beck calls Shapiro a warrior for conservatism, against those who use fear and intimidation to stifle honest debate. I've never known him to back down from a fight. And I would add, I've never known him to backing down from a good fight. From catcalling women on Twitter by asking them to debate him on the facts, to being known as a Jewish Nazi, our speaker is a true conundrum to our socialist, communist, gender-neutral counterparts. So without further ado, with a loud lion roar, please welcome the one, the only, Ben Shapiro.
Well, this is fun. Thank you for coming out. I appreciate it. So first of all, thank you to LMU Young America's Foundation students who made this happen, despite all of the hoops they had to jump through. And thanks to the administration for facilitating the event, despite the hoops that they forced people to jump through. And thanks, obviously, to law enforcement, who always make sure that we can hold events like this in the peace and quiet recommended by the First Amendment to the Constitution. Thanks also to Fred Allen for sponsoring this lecture series. It is amazing to be here, despite the hoops that administration did force YAF to jump through. For example, I saw that LMU insisted that YAF answer a bunch of questions in order for me to be able to speak here. Questions like, how will the event planners ensure that the content of the program uplifts the worth and dignity of individuals? Now, it may just be me. That seems kind of subjective. And also, it seems like it's very much dependent on how you guys react to me. So I'm going to rely on you to believe that I uplifted the worth and decency of individuals to make sure that this was all justified. Also, I noticed that you had a grand total of 5 protesters outside. Including, as I had been told, several professors, which does beg the question, or at least raise the question, as to why they don't have something better to do with their time, like, you know, create course syllabi or grade papers or read a book. Professor Nina Lozano, I guess, was one of the people outside. She said on Twitter that she didn't want me to speak because I espouse hate speech and I'm linked to numerous hate groups. This is patently false, obviously. I would like for anyone to explain to me how I espouse hate speech and which hate groups I am associated with. She also called me a white supremacist. This is the charge that people have been using very frequently. Honestly, I'm bewildered. I'm legitimately bewildered by this charge. I mean, not only am I an Orthodox Jew, not only do I have to have security with me a lot of the time because of white supremacist threats, but I was the leading antagonist of the alt-right and have been for fully 5 years at this point. I mean, legitimately, not an antagonist, their leading antagonist by statistical data. In 2016, I was hit with legitimately thousands of anti-Semitic tweets from the alt-right. Right. In my new book, I was described, because of my new book, by The Economist as the alt-right sage without the rage. I forced them to apologize. Right? They actually had to apologize to me, because the book contains no less than 4 sections in which I, by name, call out the alt-right. Calling me a white supremacist is just a way for folks on the progressive left to never have to listen to an argument they don't like and to castigate everyone they don't like as something evil. That's a bunch of bullshit. Okay. Professor Paige Edley, I guess, also said that my views were antithetical to what the LMU and the Jesuit and Marymount traditions embody. So I'd like for her to point to sections in the gospel where my viewpoints are significantly at odds. And then I would encourage this professor to do the same with mainline democratic political policies on issues ranging from life to the definition of biological sex. Professor Lozano, by the way, I will note, said that she was subjected to nasty emails up to and including death threats in response to her statements. Not only do I full-throatedly condemn that, it is evil, and anybody who issued those sorts of statements should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Now to the topic of tonight's speech, the mainstream media's big lies. So I want to start with a story that I've briefly told you already. So I write this book. This book is essentially a pop history of Western philosophy, moving forward from the Bible through Greek philosophy, through Aquinas, and on into the Enlightenment. And in the book, I routinely talk about the evils of the alt-right, about identity politics, about breaking people down by race, about the stupidity of white supremacy. One of the great ironies of white supremacy is the people who espouse it are invariably dumb. But nonetheless, The Economist, which is a center-right publication, supposedly, in Europe, labeled me the alt-right sage without the rage. And they clearly didn't know the definition of alt-right, because a lot of people don't on the left understand there is a difference between the alt-right, which believes that Western civilization is predicated on whites and white people, and conservatism, which believes that Western civilization is predicated on certain immutable, true, eternally good principles. There's a vast difference between these two philosophies, obviously. Conservatism in the United States is not a race-based philosophy. It's an individual-based philosophy, which is the opposite of that. And yet The Economist still called me alt-right. How did they get it so wrong? Well, the reason they got it so wrong is because when you have a narrative in your head and you seek to push that narrative, then the facts do not require you to actually do a simple Google search. All they had to type in was my name and alt-right, and they would have come up with a bevy of articles that I have written for places like the Washington Post, specifically calling out the alt-right. This was not a hard thing to do. But when you're in the media and you're surrounded in this echo chamber of people who agree with you, it's pretty easy to fall in the trap of thinking anyone who disagrees with me in some way is morally deficient and can be lumped in with everybody else who disagrees with me. And we're seeing this increasingly from not only people who are mainline conservatives like me, but people who are simply heterodox, people like Jordan Peterson or Joe Rogan or Dave Rubin. Anybody who doesn't agree with sort of the down-the-line left viewpoint is castigated as a pathway to the alt-right, or as a white supremacist, or as somebody who should not be heard, should be banned from campuses, should be deplatformed. All of that is a sign of bad faith. And the fact that so many in the media buy into it is indicative of the echo chamber that has been created in the media. Now, before I get to my generalized critique of the mainstream media, I think that we have to make a couple of notes here. First, there are a lot of people in the mainstream media who actually do a really good job. There are reporters on the ground doing work I'm not doing, that my publication is not doing. They're going into places that I'm not going, and they're reporting on things I don't know about. They're doing really good work. There are a bunch of people in the media who do great work. There are people in the media who do care about the truth. There are some people, this is a little fewer, who try to remove the bias from their stories, who try to see their own bias in what they're writing, and they try to remove that from their stories. Most of all, there are some good faith people in the media, many I would say, who try to correct mistakes when they get things wrong. I mean, it's true that they don't always perceive when they are getting things wrong, but at least if they are made clear to them that they're getting things wrong, at least they correct it. And good on The Economist for doing that, right? After I pointed out they were wrong, they did issue an apology, which is more than most media outlets will do these days. And I also want to point out, as a side note, that there is some diversity in the media. So when I say the media, I want to be a little more specific. I'm going to define what I mean by the mainstream media, because I don't think that it is comprehensive in scope. I don't think it's every member of every outlet. I also don't think that it's every outlet altogether. Some outlets, for example, are open about their bias. Like, I don't treat Slate.com in the same way I treat the New York Times. Some, as I say, are doing great investigative work. Some are conservative, like Daily Wire. We are open about our bias. And when President Trump says fake news, when he says fake news, sometimes he's right. Sometimes he is right that fake news is occurring, but sometimes he is not. When we categorize all bad news for President Trump as fake news, that's intellectually dishonest. And I understand. There are lots of people who say, well, when he's describing the fake news, he means only the stories that are false. President Trump is not particularly specific or meticulous about his terminology. If there's a poll that is bad for him, the poll becomes fake news. Okay, so we can all acknowledge that he broadly uses terms too broadly to apply to a specific concept. Now, with that said, there is a systemic problem in the mainstream media. And that problem is obvious from mainstream media coverage. You can't watch mainstream media like CNN or MSNBC. You can't read the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or the Chicago Tribune. You can't read any of these places without noticing the bias, because it is obvious. And forget President Trump. Forget President Trump for a second. He's obviously unending negative media coverage. Some of that is of his own making. Some of it is certainly not. Look at just President Obama, like predate President Trump. According to the Center for Media and Public Affairs, in his first 50 days in office, President Obama received 58% positive news coverage from the networks. That compared to 33% of positive coverage for George W. Bush. President Trump, by the way, stacks up. In his first 100 days, 89% of network news coverage was negative, according to the Media Research Center. That's not a shock. The media do have a point of view. And again, here is what I mean by the mainstream media, because this is the bulk of eyeballs watching media. NBC, ABC, CBS, MSNBC, CNN, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Associated Press, The Agence France-Presse, Reuters, McClatchy, The Los Angeles Times, even the news section of The Wall Street Journal. In fact, studies have shown the news section of The Wall Street Journal is actually to the left of the news section of The New York Times. It's just the editorial page of The Wall Street Journal is significantly to the right of the editorial page of all the other major newspapers. So where does the bias come from? It comes from the fact that it's an echo chamber. When you're an echo chamber and everybody agrees with you, it's pretty easy to become biased without even thinking about it. Researchers from the Arizona State University and Texas A&M They questioned 462 financial journalists around the country in 2017. Now, you would figure financial journalists probably tend to lean a little bit more right than the general journalistic population. Here is what they found. 17.5% said they were very liberal. 40.1% said they were somewhat liberal. About 37% called themselves moderate. Just 0.46% called themselves very conservative, and just 3.94% said they were somewhat conservative. Okay, so that means that something around 4.5% of all financial journalists, right, this is an area where, you know, liking capitalism might be useful, only 4.5% said that they were either very or somewhat conservative. There's another study of journalistic attitudes called The Journalist in the Digital Age. It found that as of 1971, Republicans, self-identified Republicans, represented about 26% of journalists. Democrats represented about 36% of journalists. By 2014, only 7.1% of journalists identified as Republican. And this is obvious to anybody, right? It's obvious to the heads of our social media companies. Jack Dorsey has admitted at Twitter that conservative employees, quote, don't feel safe to express their opinions. The head of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, admits that Silicon Valley is an extremely left-leaning place. These are the folks who are constructing the algorithms that determine which news is going to be elevated and which news is not. Now, we can learn how the algorithms work. Like, we at Daily Wire are extremely good at Facebook. Our articles do serious traffic on Facebook. But that, it would be foolish to pretend that the people who are constructing the algorithms don't have political bias embedded, because they do. And Americans know this. Our trust in media institutions is at an all-time low. According to Gallup, 66% of Americans believe that the media have a hard time separating fact from opinion, and the other 34% are unconscious. Republicans, rightly so, are particularly skeptical. A June 2018 Axios SurveyMonkey poll found 92% of Republicans believe that the media intentionally report false stories, and the other 8% believe Elvis is still alive. So let's break this down. Let's break down where the lies actually lie. There's one really big lie above all else in the mainstream media, and then there are two types of bias, which kind of manifests as multiple lies in how coverage is done. The biggest lie, and the one that matters most, is the "we are objective" lie. The media are not objective truth tellers. They are not objective truth tellers. They have attitudes, they have belief systems, and those manifest in how they cover things. And it is always puzzling to me when you talk to journalists, because I have a lot of friends who are journalists, and they vote, they have opinions on the issues, but then when it comes to their news coverage, they say, no, I am perfectly objective. Why can't you just say what your opinions are, so then we can take your coverage of the issues with the grain of salt that it deserves? You know, back in 2012, I was covering the RNC. At the time, I was working for Breitbart, which I would later leave over anger at the alt-right and their coverage of President Trump, particularly. And I was covering the RNC, and Sam Donaldson, who's a very famous journalist for those who are young, Sam Donaldson was famous around the time I was born, which means 10 years before all of you were born. And he used to go at it with Ronald Reagan on a regular basis, he and his eyebrows. And Sam Donaldson, at this time, was hosting a radio show on ABC Radio Networks. And it was an opinion show all about why the left was essentially correct. And so I went up to him and I said, you know, Mr. Donaldson, it's an honor to meet you. Why is it, he was, you know, eager to talk. I said, well, why is it that you have all these opinions? Did you have all these opinions when you were a journalist? Or is this like a new thing? He said, no, I had all these opinions when I was a journalist. And I said, well, were you objective then? And he said, well, no, I mean, I had all these opinions when I was a journalist. And I said, so why didn't you just say that? And he said, what, you think you're better than I am? And I said, well, yeah, actually. Because, I mean, I'll tell you where I stand. Why won't you tell me where you stand? The polls show that members of the media have attitudes, and those attitudes are obvious from the media coverage, and they manifest in the media coverage. The fact is, the reason that Donald Trump was nominated by Republicans had a lot to do with the media coverage of people like Mitt Romney. If Mitt Romney had not been treated like garbage by the mainstream media, if he had not been treated as an evil psychopath who strapped dogs to the top of cars, forcibly cut the hair of gay kids, and wanted to put y'all back in chains, then the likelihood that somebody like Donald Trump, a ridiculous reality television star, ends up as the nominee for the Republican Party is extraordinarily low. But it's because Trump was militant with the media that a lot of Republicans resonated to that. They said, okay, fine, you're gonna call us the bad guy. What if we nominate the actual bad guy just to punch you guys in the grill? That was the motivating factor behind Trump's nomination, right? It was a giant middle finger to all of the sophisticates who had suggested that Mitt Romney, the most milquetoast human being ever yet to walk the earth, was somehow an emissary of evil. You can see that the media, in their treatment of stories ranging from Michael Brown in Ferguson to Jussie Smollett, the initial jump of the media is to believe all stories that back a particular narrative. And this brings us to the two types of bias in the media. There are two types of bias that are important. There's selection bias, and then there's actual narrative bias. So selection bias is what the media choose to cover. You get a lot of this in your, a lot of this, by the way, applies to your professors. So professors can bias a course, not just by getting up in class and ripping on President Trump or talking about why profits are bad, yada, yada. They can bias a course simply by not assigning you a wide variety of reading materials, just assigning you one end of the spectrum. And this is what the media do. Selection bias matters. The media determine what to cover and what not to cover. So let's take, for example, coverage of the crisis along the border. So if you are older than 3 months old, you will recall that just a couple of months ago, we had a big fight over whether we should fund the government because President Trump wanted his funding for the border. And he was saying there's a crisis at the border. And the media were like, no, this is manufactured. There's no crisis at the border, guys. I mean, come on. What? Crisis at the border? Fast forward 3 months. Jay Johnson, the Secretary of Homeland Security, is suddenly on the news explaining there's a crisis at the border. And then when did it start? It started back in January in the middle of the government shutdown. The tens of thousands of people were arriving at the border. We didn't have the resources to cope with those people. And now the media are running story after story on a daily basis about the humanitarian crisis at the border. Might that have made a difference in the middle of the debate that was happening in January? I think it might have. But the media weren't covering those stories until that debate ended, and then it was convenient to cover the stories to talk about how the Trump administration was incompetent in handling a crisis that was burgeoning on the border. Or take, for example, the media's focus on hate crimes. So the media jumped right into the Jussie Smollett story, right? This was evidence that America was a deeply racist, sexist, bigoted, homophobic place. This was the best case example of why America stunk, because Chicago is MAGA country and people get rounded up on the streets of Chicago in the middle of a polar vortex and grabbed around the neck with a noose and hit with bleach, but they never lose hold of their Subway sandwich. But that's because America's bad, right? That's because Trump supporters are really bad. They jump all over that story. Now, in a second, we'll talk about the fact that it took them weeks, legitimately, to walk back all of that, and they humiliated themselves on that basis. But the same night that Jussie Smollett was allegedly assaulted, and it turns out that Jussie Smollett saw his attacker in the mirror that night too, that went... the same night that Jussie Smollett was beat up by friends of Jussie Smollett, there was an actual hate crime in New York City in which an Orthodox Jew was walking the streets of Brooklyn and was assaulted. And it was caught on tape. So this was not a matter of the tape disappeared and here's my narrative. It was like, here's an actual tape of a hate crime happening, like tonight. And it was not covered virtually anywhere. Why wasn't it covered? Well, the reason it wasn't covered is because it didn't fit a particular narrative, right? This is where the selection bias comes in. The media choose what exactly they want to cover. And sometimes they'll even admit it. The single most illuminating mainstream media story I've seen in the last 5 years came out of the New York Times. This is back in November of last year. They noted that there had been a major spike in the number of hate crimes against Jews in New York City. And here's what they said. Contrary to what are surely the prevailing assumptions, anti-Semitic incidents have constituted half of all hate crimes in New York this year, according to the police department. Now, you can tell the bias there immediately from the beginning of the sentence. Contrary to what are surely the prevailing assumptions. Who made those assumptions? Why are they prevailing? Maybe it's because you were crafting a narrative. Why didn't the Times cover that massive increase in anti-Semitic hate crimes in New York City? Because as they admitted, quote, during the past 22 months, not one person caught or identified as the aggressor in an anti-Semitic hate crime has been associated with a far right-wing group. If anti-Semitism bypasses consideration as a serious problem in New York, it is to some extent because it refuses to conform to an easy narrative with a single ideological enemy. In fact, it is the varied backgrounds of people who commit hate crimes in the city that makes combating and talking about anti-Semitism in New York much harder. Bias stemming from long-standing ethnic tensions in the city presents complexities that many liberals have chosen simply to ignore. When a Hasidic man or woman is attacked by anyone in New York City, mainstream progressive advocacy groups do not typically send out emails calling for concern and fellowship and candlelight vigils in Union Square, as they often do when individuals are harmed in New York because of race or ethnicity or how they identify in terms of gender or sexual orientation. That is the New York Times openly admitting to you that they botched their news coverage because they are attempting to cover specific kinds of hate crimes. That an actual uptick in hate crimes in New York City that targets Jews and that is largely driven or disproportionately driven by minorities, that is not worth covering because that is not the prevailing assumption. This was, by the way, one of the reasons that the left missed the story of 2016, selection bias. They decided that they were going to cover the war on women and they were going to cover the upswing of feminism. They weren't going to cover the guy who was out of a job in Ohio who President Trump was talking to. And that's why after the election, you had the New York Times basically saying, oh yeah, we kind of blew that one. Now we need a Steve Irwin-like character to go into the wilds of North America and talk with these forgotten people. Who could these people be? These people living in the middle of the country. What is this Ohio you speak of? The second type of bias that the media engage in regularly is, of course, narrative bias. So selection bias is driven by what is covered and what is not covered. Narrative bias is driven by an attempt to uncover evidence on behalf of a particular narrative. So the most obvious case in point here is, of course, the Russian collusion hoax. Okay, so this has been one of the media's worst botches in recent memory. Now, let's start with a couple of basics. There is evidence that members of Team Trump were willing to take intel about Hillary Clinton from people connected with the Russian government, right? That's the Trump Tower meeting. All of that is on record. We know all of that. It's baked into the cake. We can also acknowledge that members of Team Trump acted weird. Okay, that's true. Also, President Trump said a lot of weird stuff about Russia. Not because President Trump is in Putin's pocket, but because anybody who says something nice about Trump will receive a kind word in response. This is just how President Trump operates. If you say a nice thing about President Trump, he loves you, and if you say something mean, then he hits you like a hammer on a baby. Like, that's just what he does. But the media wouldn't wait for the evidence. For the media, every day was the possible boom, the bombshell that was going to take down the Trump administration. Collusion was just a matter of time. We were going to uncover this thing, and when we uncovered it, it was going to rip the state of American politics wide open. We didn't have to wait for the evidence to speculate, in fact, and we could blow stories on a routine basis. You have to start acknowledging that there's a narrative bias when every error a media outlet makes skews to one side. When was the last time CNN ran a story exonerating President Trump? They didn't, right? There were several stories in which they ran stories that attempted to implicate Trump and his team in bad stuff that turned out not to be true. Most famously, they said that Donald Trump Jr. had received early information from WikiLeaks. That turned out not to be true. He got information that was already publicly available in an email several days after WikiLeaks went public with the information. But when every error moves to one side, you got to assume bias. Right? That's what you would do at my site, as well you should. We are a conservative site. I assume that our errors are probably going to result from confirmation bias. Well, the same thing is true with regard to the media. Why were the media covering the Russian collusion story this way? Because there were many members of the media who desperately hoped that it was true. They couldn't accept the fact that Trump won the election, and so it was Hillary didn't legitimately lose because she was a terrible garbage candidate. The proof of which is that she lost to Donald J. Trump for the presidency. No, the real story was that it had to be the Trump campaign, which, by the way, okay, like, I was there. That was the most chaotic, least professional campaign I have ever seen. It was not close. And yet, the prevailing theory of the media is that this botchery of a campaign was so sophisticated that at night they would shut down all of the stupid, and then they would go into a skiff, they would go into a protected area, and then they would get on the phone with Vladimir Putin and say, Vlad, if you could hit precisely this Wisconsin precinct with this particular Facebook ad, then we can win this election for you, man, and then Crimea is yours. Right? That was the theory. And I don't want to conflate objective media and opinion media because they're two different things, but I will say that a lot of members of the mainstream media were of opinions that very much reflected the opinion media. Right? So I remember I was on Bill Maher's show, and I like Bill Maher personally. I think he's a nice guy. Our interaction on the show was nice. We were supposed to talk about free speech issues. About 5 minutes before I go on, his producer comes in and says, you know, Bill wants to talk about Russia tonight. And I said, okay, well, I guess we can do that. I mean, I don't care. I think it's dumb, but sure. And so the conversation went something like this. Bill Maher saying, don't you think that President Trump is guilty of collusion with Russia? And I said, well, I haven't seen the evidence of that. I'm happy to wait for the Mueller report to come out, and then we'll find out the evidence. And him saying, you really don't believe he was guilty of collusion? And I said, right, because I'm, like, waiting for the evidence. And Bill Maher was like, but really, you don't believe it? And it occurred to me that no amount of evidence would actually be sufficient to cure people of a perception on this stuff. And you see this for the media now, who are now, of course, turning the narrative to, well, it must be a cover-up by the Attorney General. Just wait, guys. It's coming out in the next few days. Like, cool your jets for a second. But the narrative bias, where you skew a narrative so that it favors one side versus the other, is particularly obvious. And it's obvious in nearly every case, from the Israel-Palestinian issue, where the only time that is ever covered is not when Hamas is firing rockets into the middle of Israel or when Hamas is shooting Gazan citizens, but only when Israel retaliates. It's true everywhere from there to the Covington Catholic boys, who suddenly become brutal racists based on a clipped piece of video that was taken out of context, and then it was covered for a week even after it came out that wasn't true, as though, well, you know, maybe we got this wrong, but isn't it indicative of a broader story? And the narrative always moves something like this. We tell the story that confirms our bias. Then it turns out the story wasn't true. Then the conversation becomes not how did we screw this up, it becomes, but doesn't it raise larger issues? Aren't you glad we're having an important conversation right now? And it's like, no, I'm not glad we're having that conversation right now. I mean, that's like I come home at night and my wife is like, you committed adultery. And I'm like, no, I absolutely didn't. I really didn't. She's like, but aren't you glad we're having this conversation? Like, no. Most obviously, this was the case with Brett Kavanaugh, where the story was, well, obviously Brett Kavanaugh did something wrong. I mean, we believe all women. And then a couple of other women come forward, and their stories fall apart. It's like, well, do we believe those women? Like Julie Swetnick, like the Michael Avenatti lady who's claiming gang rape? Do you believe her? We're not going to talk about her anymore. Believe all women except for her. And all of this means that when a story is blown, it becomes difficult. We become skeptical of the motivations of the media, because they won't just admit what they are. If they admitted what they were, then I would trust their motives. I know your motives, you've said your motives. But it's hard for me to attribute good motives when you're constantly making errors in the same direction and you won't admit why that is happening. The only answer to this is radical honesty. The truth is, for most of American history, the press were openly partisan. I am a big fan of this. I think it is a very good thing. I think it is good when the press admit their biases up front. And then, if you want to know what the facts are, it's actually not all that hard. You want to know what the facts are? Look at the Huffington Post, look at the Daily Wire. The stuff that we have in common in coverage of a story is probably the factual nexus, and everything else is opinion. Right, you can do this, you just have to read two sources. Right, there are two intersecting lines, that's it. And find that nexus, that's probably the factual basis, and everything else is opinion. That's a better way of doing this than pretending that the New York Times was gifted by God with the incredible ability to discern their own opinion from fact. You know, it's actually kind of amazing, the rise of objective journalism, of quote-unquote objective journalism, really it only started in mainstream, in the media, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and it was in the aftermath of the New York Times being too anti-communist. And Walter Lippmann, who's a columnist, he started the New Republic, he wrote in this very famous column that the New York Times had biased its coverage against the Bolsheviks, and thus we needed a more objective news media who are experts in what they do. Let me tell you something about members of the media. Most of them are not experts in what they do. There are people who are experts in the areas that they cover, but the vast majority of people who are in the media, particularly in television media, this is true, don't know things. They don't know a lot of things. So we ought to stop giving people credibility until they prove a level of knowledge, and we ought to assume motives, because people do have motives. And this has been true forever. There was no halcyon era where the media was trustable. Walter Cronkite was biased, and what he said about the Tet Offensive was flatly not true. Edward R. Murrow was biased. That doesn't mean that biased people can't commit acts of journalism. It happens all the time, and it's great. We're all biased. It does mean that we need to admit that bias. If the media would do that, that would be the first step toward restoring the credibility that we require in order to have a common basis of facts from which to draw our discussions. Thanks so much. Happy to take your questions.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, can you please walk around? Do not walk up this aisle or... So, can you walk back to Robert in the back? Wait. Questions will be... Keep your question to a question. I'll be holding the mic for you. And we're ready for the first question.
And I always have a rule, which is that if you disagree with me on anything, it's not restricted to the topic of the speech, raise your hand, you go to the front of the line.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Big fan.
Oh, thank you.
I have a dilemma. I agree with you with everything that you talk about, abortion, right? The moment the two come together, that's it, we have a baby, and it's murder if you kill it. Now, there's something I can't reconcile with myself. The stats, as you know, since 1973, 55 million children were aborted in the United States. And would you consider kids that are unwanted, that are often neglected, you know, badly treated, no father, blah, blah, blah. So I'm thinking forcing small-minded people, I want to say, to have children because they didn't think it through, or they were drunk, or whatever. I'm sorry, my phone, I can't believe that. Wow, that's like a bad movie. This Ben Shapiro, stop. Oh, sorry. So, you know what I mean? So to force people that didn't think it through, were drunk, or not to have babies that are unwanted, 55 million. So I'm thinking, I have children, and I'm thinking, what would it look like today in our world? That's the question. What would I look like today in this in our world for these children to be forced in with the mess that we get out there? So I believe in, so, you know, the children, but this mess that...
So the here's my view of the birth of children. The world would be significantly better with all of those children alive. I think the basis of... The basis of innovation and human ingenuity is obviously the creation of new human beings. And as far as the living conditions of a lot of these folks, the question is how we get kids into healthy households and how do we create an incentive structure that makes it easier for kids to grow up in a two-parent family. A lot of that has to do with welfare reforms that don't pay people to have babies out of wedlock. And the fact is that across the board, the single motherhood rate has risen dramatically across our society. It's a terrible, terrible thing. It's true across races. 70% of black kids are born out of wedlock, over 40% of white kids are born out of wedlock. Obviously, that's a disaster area for the children involved. But to the sort of Freakonomics argument, which is that our society would be a hellscape if all these kids had been born, first of all, I think that if we had not changed our social standards at the same time with regard to abortion and marriage, then we would be much better off. These kids wouldn't be born into single parent families. I mean, it is statistically true that we have devalued marriage so much that we've left kids are the ones who pay the price for that. And the idea of you get pregnant and then you have a baby out of wedlock, that was not a thing for the vast majority of American history. The actual thing was if you got pregnant out of wedlock, you married the father of the baby. A huge percentage of babies in the United States were born as 7-month babies, meaning that somebody got pregnant and then they were 2 months pregnant at the wedding, and then they were born 7 months later. Honestly, that's a hell of a lot better than a kid being either killed in the womb or brought into the world without a father. So bringing back into being the standard that you should only have sex with people you are willing to marry, and frankly, you shouldn't have sex, and the willingness to marry is best shown by actual marriage, in my view. So you should really have sex with the person you are married to. And I know this is a real rough one, but I did it myself, so it's doable. Placing responsibility on parents is the key to bringing back better lives for children. And again, I never think that the death of a child in any form, unborn or born, is a solution to poverty, for example.
Hello, Ben. My name is Tomas Morales. And throughout the Western world, there is an increasing attempt to
I'm just going to admire your mustache until you're ready.
Oh, okay,
so.
Thank you. Okay, there is an increasing attempt to strip our rights away. So in New Zealand, there is, you know, those potential gun grabs. We have an increasing amount. There's an increasing amount of tech censorship, and the Western world is embraced. Okay. Yeah. So my question is the West truly? Is decline, or was President when he said that freedom is never in away from extinction?
Yeah, I mean, so the question was for folks who can't hear that is the West truly in decline, or is freedom never more than one generation away from extinction? I mean, the truth is both, right? If you have a people who don't remember the bases of their civilization, it's very difficult to preserve that civilization. That's basically why I wrote my new book, right, The Right Side of History. Available anywhere, booksellers. But as far as the West being in decline, yeah, I mean, I think that people have fundamentally disconnected from a lot of those values, and that's a disaster area, because the truth is, as I say at the beginning of the book, we live in the best time. This is the best time. You would not pick another time to be born into. You are the most prosperous, you are the most free, people are bothering you the least. You can expect that any child born today, unless they're born with some sort of serious genetic condition, is gonna live for 80 years, which is insane. Anybody who was born in 1800 and airlifted here would suddenly think that they had literally died and gone to heaven. That's what they would think. Except that they would look around and say, why are people so unhappy and so ungrateful? And why is it they've abandoned all the fundamental roots of the civilization that built all of this in the first place? That's why I really believe that the best thing that we can do is move into the educational mode about the fundamental roots of that civilization and stop pretending that economic do-gooderism is somehow going to fix what is effectively a problem of soul. Again, we are richer than any people have ever been. And if we're unhappy, that doesn't seem to me a direct effect of a trade policy. That seems to me more of a direct effect of the death of social capital, social fabric, and a lot of that, in my opinion, is linked to the death of belief in Judeo-Christian values and human reason.
Okay, just a reminder, keep your question to a question, not a statement. Thank you.
What exactly do you think should be done about big tech companies that are like censoring people? Because obviously the free market is a great thing, but when it comes into censoring of the big tech.
Yeah, so I think that the big tech companies are getting away with a bit of a bait and switch here. And that is that they are acting like editorial sites and pretending that they are platforms. So think of it this way. There's two types of services that you can use for speech. One is a website like mine. I edit it, we cultivate it, we decide what goes up. If it doesn't meet our editorial standards, it doesn't go up. And therefore, we are liable for the stuff that we print if it were libelous or defamatory in some way or false. If we put up a non-copyrighted picture, we would get sued. Right? That's because we're responsible for the material we put up. And then there is the common carrier kind of platform view, which is it's a phone line. So when you get on the phone with your friends, if you say something really dumb or you say something that is a violation of law, that's not AT&T's fault. AT&T may suck for other reasons, but that's not their fault. And so The Facebook and Twitter, they've been treated by the law as platforms, where they're not responsible for what people say on those platforms. But then they're stepping in and they're editing what people are saying on the platforms and kicking people off, not for violation of law reasons or legal liability reasons, but because they wish to push certain points of view or certain other points of view. Well, from that perspective, you sound a lot more like my website than you do like AT&T. Well, if that's the case, then you become liable for the material that is on your site. So if you actually want to force these tech companies back into what they were supposed to do in the first place, namely provide a platform without favor to particular points of view, and then we can have an open debate about those ideas, then I'm perfectly happy with that. But if you want to be acting as though Jack Dorsey gets to edit what you see, or Mark Zuckerberg gets to decide which viewpoints ought to be given more value, well, now you're an editorial site and you ought to be treated that way. And every copyright violation you should be held responsible for, and every violation of law you should be held responsible for. And Facebook and Twitter would be bankrupt in a day. So either rediscover your fundamental mission or be stripped of your legal immunity is, I think, the way to do this.
I had a pretty specific question. So I've heard you talk a lot about healthcare, and a thing that a lot of people bring up is the Nordic model of government healthcare. And I've heard you make the argument that the success of these models is due in part to the ethnic and cultural homogeneity of these societies. And I was just wondering how specifically does the culture and ethnic homogeneity of these places contribute to the success of their healthcare?
Sure. So cultural homogeneity contributes to success of healthcare in the sense that people in Nordic countries, for example, tend to eat healthier. Right, that's a cultural thing. How we eat is differentiated among many different cultures. In Norway, they tend to eat pretty healthy. That makes a difference into how much you are going to spend. Ethnic homogeneity matters because different ethnicities get different diseases at different rates. So heart disease is diagnosed more often among black men than among white men. That has nothing to do with racism. That has to do with just diagnosis. So if you have a different population, then the measurements of diagnoses and the costs pertaining thereto are going to be different. So that is true in virtually every aspect. This is why when I say if you want to compare apples to apples, what you wouldn't do is compare Sweden to the United States in terms of the effects of the healthcare system. What you would do is take a Swedish population in the United States and say, how does their healthcare look, as opposed to a Swedish population in Sweden? That's comparing apples to apples as opposed to two disparate populations. That's effectively the argument that I'm making. I can hear you, and I'll repeat the question for folks here. Right. So, first of all, let me start. So the question was, is there a place for atheism in the modern world, and what's the social utility of religion? Is that what, I want to boil it down fairly. So when it comes down to, is there a place for atheism? Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a good dialectical debate about religion. I think it makes religion stronger. I mean, I've had these debates with Sam Harris, and I think they're really interesting and useful. I've done the same thing with Michael Shermer on my Sunday special. I think it makes me question my own values, which is good. It makes me strengthen, come up with new arguments, if that's something that I want to do. And that's really good. I know a lot of moral atheists who, frankly, are more moral than some of the religious people I know. So I've never made the argument that religion is necessary for an individual to be moral. What I have suggested is that you cannot base an entire civilization on atheistic premises, because I believe that atheism tends toward both nihilism and scientific materialism, and it's difficult to build a civilization on that basis. As far as the social utility of religion, this is proven by virtually every social science study. So virtually all social science suggests that social fabric is deeply necessary in order to have a feeling of happiness and well-being in a community, and also to preserve freedom. So to take a perfectly obvious example, you have poor people in your community. And in my community, in the Jewish community, pretty tight-knit community, when somebody is poor and they can't get through the holidays, they have a place to go, right? They go to the shul, and I give money to the shul, and that is redistributed to the person. And that's a voluntary duty that I take upon myself for religious reasons, because I believe like the people in my synagogue believe. And this is true for churches all over the United States, synagogues, mosques all over the United States. Right, this is true throughout the world. De Tocqueville talks about this in Democracy in America. He says that the social fabric that allows for freedom to grow in the absence of government is largely church-based. You do need these religious communities in order to provide the safety net and also the sense of not only well-being but purpose. That you can't really have a diverse community unless you have a common goal. So what is that common goal going to be? Now maybe you can find an ersatz common goal, like a different common goal to mobilize around. So in example of this would be the army, right? That's a non-religious common goal. People mobilize around it. Very diverse group of people who go in. They all have the same purpose. They get along. It's one of the great things. I mean, this is what Robert Putnam talks about in Bowling Alone. But in a non-army context, the single greatest builder of social fabric in the history of the United States and the Western world is, in fact, church. And it remains so. If you want to see a dying community in the United States, a place with high opioid addiction levels, high suicide rates, The best indicator is probably not even economic level. The best indicator is lack of churches, functional churches, in that town. Because once the church is dissolved, people don't feel close to each other, they don't feel like they need to take care of each other. And I don't think the government can make that up simply by signing somebody a check. It doesn't give you a sense of purpose, it doesn't give you a sense of community. And you need both a sense of purpose and a sense of community in order to live a happy life and provide a grid work for a freedom-based system where we can allow each other to live comfortably knowing that we're going to take care of each other outside the auspices of government force. You can have a quick follow-up, that's fine. I'm sorry, and a quick thing on China. China's not irreligious because everybody decides to be atheist. China's irreligious because the Communist Party of China actively quashes religion and persecutes Christians. I mean, it is. That's why the Communist Party is doing its best to quash religion in China, right? I mean, they're actively trying to stop churches from forming in China and prosecuting people.
Yeah. Can I shake your hand?
Sure.
They don't allow that. Okay.
We have to go back that way.
Well, another time.
Hi, Ben. So I have an article of yours in front of me that you wrote. The title is, I Will Never Vote for Donald Trump. And the first lines are, I will never vote for Donald Trump, ever. In 2018 on the Bill Maher show, you said that you would vote for Trump. So what changed?
So what changed is that the Never Trump position, and that article was written specifically about 2016. And I'll tell you what I was hoping to avoid with President Trump. So I was worried about three specific things, and I've said this many times. I was worried about three specific things. And I wrote, by the way, another piece in that same election cycle in National Review called What Trump Would Have to Do for Me to Vote for Him. So people ignore that article. But in any case, the three things I was worried about with President Trump were, number one, that President Trump was going to soul-suck the Republican Party, that he was going to do crazy, bad things, and many Republicans were going to follow him down that path and pretend that all of these things were okay. That's been kind of half true. I mean, you've seen some of that for sure. The other thing that I was afraid of is that they were going to follow him in terms of ideas and that he wasn't going to be particularly conservative. That one has turned out not to be so true. Most people don't see Trump as a thought leader. Also, he's been much more conservative than I thought he was going to be based on his rhetoric. He was all over the place during the election. You recall that he said that he was in favor of universal health care, but also against universal health care. He was legitimately on every side of every issue, like Joe Biden. I mean, so I was worried about that. That tends not to have materialized as much. And then I was worried, and this one is definitely still on the table, that he was going to absolutely toxify the Republican Party and the conservative movement among young people. And that has been true. By polling data, he has made the Republican Party even more toxic than it was among young people, and so that continues to be a worry. Now, with all of that said, him being president changes the math, because now he's the president. So I get to evaluate him on what I call the sometimes Trump basis, because now I don't get to vote for him again until 2020, right? So it's not like I'm not voting for him today. So now I get to determine whether he did something good today or something bad today, just like I adjudicate that with literally every other human being in my life. I do it with my 2-year-old son. Did he do something good this moment, or did he do something bad this moment? And there are many other similarities between the president and my 2-year-old son. I won't even go here. But with that said, am I more likely to vote for Trump? Yeah, because the evidence has changed. So based on the evidence of 2016, I don't think I did the wrong thing. Based on the new evidence as to how he has governed, how he is treated by the Republican Party, and the fact that the Democrats could not do the one thing they had to do, which was not be insane people, and have decided that they instead are going to embrace the worst aspects of their own id, that changes the math. So that, because that's changed the math, with changing evidence, you change your views.
Hey, Ben, thanks for coming. My question was pretty similar to that one, so I'm going to go with a backup here. You're libertarian on certain issues like marijuana use and gay marriage, even though you've said those are harmful on a societal level. Where does the line get drawn between things that you think are bad for society but you think should not be illegal, like those two, and things that you think are bad for society and should be illegal? In other words, where does the government intervention start and end, and how do you draw that line?
So direct externalities is the general way to draw the line. I'm very much in the mold of John Stuart Mill here. The idea here is that you get to wave your fist around until you hit me in the face. So if you wave your fist around and hit you in the face, that's not great for society, but it's your decision to hit yourself in the face, Jussie Smollett. So when it comes to drug use, particularly drug use that doesn't harm anyone else, it's a little different with drugs like PCP, for example, or if you happen to be driving while you're high. That's a different thing. But if you're just smoking up marijuana and you decide that you want to lose a bunch of brain cells before your brain is fully developed, I think it's a bad decision, but I guess it's on you. And the same thing is true with regard to same-sex marriage. The reason that I'm libertarian on same-sex marriage is, again, because you're not impacting anyone directly other than the people who you're interacting with. And I'm much more afraid, actually, that the government is going to cram down its version of marriage on my religious institution than that the government goes libertarian and leaves me alone.
I'll just stick on marijuana, but I think the same point can be made for the same-sex marriage. But if marijuana is making people just simply worse citizens, and that, I think, would have a negative impact on society as a whole, how do you differentiate between things which are very obvious, like someone who's high on PCP, or they're going out, you know, and they're, you know, whatever, killing somebody, versus someone who's high on marijuana in the argument that you've made, which makes them a worse citizen, less productive, things like that? How do you draw between those two negative impacts on society as a whole?
So again, I think there is a logical distinction between direct impact on society and indirect. I think there's a secondary argument to be made here, which is that there are legitimately drugs that rob you of your ability to be a functioning citizen. I'm not aware that marijuana as a whole does that. I know a lot of people who smoke marijuana. Again, something I don't like, and I think is, despite Joe Rogan's perspective on this, which we discussed at length today, I am not, you know, perfectly pro-use of marijuana. Maybe there's some people who can use it productively. I don't know enough about marijuana to know that. But there are certain drugs that you definitely cannot use productively, like heroin. And if it makes you unable to participate in the functions of our democracy, there is at least a case to be made that you are now creating directly a cost on society that doesn't exist with, say, alcohol or marijuana, where you actually have to abuse the substance. And I'm not sure there's any way to not abuse heroin. With that said, I think there's a good libertarian argument even on harder drugs, frankly, as long as there's no direct impact on anyone else. But that means that you have to own your decision-making, meaning that if you are a cost, the cost is on you. You decide to smoke marijuana and be unproductive, I'm not going to sign a check for you. That is your choice. And now you're going to have to live with your bad choice.
Hi, Ben. My name is Chance. I'm just a really big fan. And I was wondering if you could sign my book.
Sure. He's going to take it for you, and then I'll sign it for you. No problem. Thanks for buying it, by the way.
Hi, Ben. Thanks so much for coming. I'm asking a question on my brother's behalf. So this is just directly from him. Follow him, Jake Stamen, on Twitter. You've said many times that we should reduce welfare spending, but lately my brother feels like our country is too in too deep for that to be realistic on a political level. Throwing people off their government benefits would make Republicans look evil, especially if no replacement for welfare is offered. In this opinion, the ideal welfare system would look something like Milton Friedman's negative income tax, which were with work requirements. When you're president, would you... would you ever consider supporting a proposal like that? And if not, how would you go about successfully passing cuts to welfare programs, especially when considering how popular they are with voters?
Well, I do think that one of the best political moves that I've seen in my lifetime was welfare reform, which attached welfare to work requirements. There's a lot of talk about catastrophic impact on people, and that simply wasn't the case. People started to work more. It did increase employment rates. You don't want to pay people not to work. Now, the UBI argument that I usually hear is not the, we are dependent on this and what are we going to do. Transitioning people off welfare, honestly, I think that looks more like the social fabric picking up the slack, people making a plan with the money that they're being given. You know, that it's not just we sign you a check, but what are you going to use the money for? Are you going to use the money to actually get yourself out of debt, or are you going to go blow that money on something else? I'm not averse to having strings attached to welfare programs, particularly from the local level, where you know the people who are signing you the checks. Usually the argument is the Elon Musk or Andrew Yang argument. By the way, I did an interview with Andrew Yang. It's on our Sunday special this Sunday. Nearly the entire interview, or at least a huge portion of it, is about this exact issue, UBI. So the Milton Friedman proposal, first of all, is that UBI would actually replace all of the welfare system, right? That there wouldn't be 750 welfare systems, that instead there would just be this one check, and the check would be dependent on your income, and you'd get a negative income tax, you would get a certain check in the mail, and that's it. I'm not sure that fulfills two basic needs that we are seeing in society right now. Need number one is the need for a job. If you are unemployed, there are a lot of people on disability right now. People are paying their bills. It is not making them less likely to commit suicide or be on opioids or... It's not. They're not engaging in all the things that Democrats keep saying they're going to engage in. They're not going out and creating great art. They're not going out there and picking up a new hobby or volunteering with their time for the most part. They're doing what they were doing before, which is not working and being upset, right? Jobs do provide purpose. So I'm not sure that signing a check fills that gap. I think only social fabric and you know, finding purposeful things to do fills that gap. As far as the argument that it is going to be of economic benefit to sign massive checks on future debt, I'm not sure how that is the case. That's why the argument usually for UBI is all the jobs are going away anyway. There's nothing you can do about it. Now what do? You have a vast underclass of people who don't have jobs and they're going to come kill you. Okay, well, if that's the given, then I don't have much of a choice, do I? I don't happen to think that's the way economics historically has worked. Historically, technological advancements do come along with new jobs. The fact is that technology is used by workers in different ways, right? I mean, everybody works with a computer now. They didn't work for, would there be more jobs if everybody were writing by pen and using an abacus? Maybe. Would we all be better off? No. So when it comes to UBI or any of these other proposals, I think the question is, how closely tailored is it to the purpose that it says it's closely tailored? Is it an attempt to avoid poverty, or is it an attempt to provide meaning? If it's to provide meaning, the answer is no. If it's to avoid poverty, then the answer is a qualified maybe, but that should be a last resort. And it seems to me government welfare is being used as a first resort by people rather than as a last resort in the absence of a social fabric. As far as convincing people, listen, we have a gap in the mind. The gap is we want less spending, and then as soon as we say what we want to cut, everybody goes, no, you can't touch that. True of Social Security, true of Medicare. These represent 66% of the federal budget. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that's 66% of the federal budget. Will anybody ever have the balls to actually say we need to restructure this stuff? No, because then you lose elections. Which is why I'm not running.
Both of them. Okay, I got two. This is a question for the Hebrew Hammer. So in terms of hate speech, whether it's for, against, whatever, whether it's from a politician, a student, a protester, somebody who's working at a company, what do you think, where is the line between what the government or a private industry should and should not censor, and what should and should not be prosecuted by the law, especially with what seems like a increase and resurgence in anti-Semitism and white supremacy, or just any sort of racial tensions that are going on right now?
I mean, to my own detriment, I'm going to say that nearly nothing should be regulated. The only things that should be regulated or censored are legitimate threats of violence and libelous material. And people here always say fire in a crowded theater. That's because they don't understand the Schenck ruling, which was largely overruled by the Supreme Court later. That is not a broad ruling. It was never meant to be a broad ruling, and its use at the time was justified in what was justified by used by Woodrow Wilson as justification to arrest political opponents. So I'd much rather have I'm more willing to have a free and open political sphere, even if there are more crazies out there, than to have the government sit over all of us and determine what is acceptable speech and what is not acceptable speech. And I've been the target of more unacceptable speech, in my view, than most everyone that I know. And yet I have consistently stood for the proposition that people who have specifically targeted me ought not be even deplatformed, forget about prosecuted, but even deplatformed, unless they are making openly violent threats against me and are threatening my family's safety. Everybody knows, I'm not a Milo Yiannopoulos fan. When he was thrown off Twitter, I said that was wrong. I'm not an Alex Jones fan. I think he's a joke and a bad person to boot. Anybody who does what he has done with Sandy Hook is not my cup of tea. Also, they're turning the frogs gay. But when Alex Jones was banned from Twitter and Facebook, unless they actually had a legal excuse to do so, I don't see how you can do that and call yourself a free speech platform in any way. Now, are there market ramifications to saying things? Sure. I mean, there are, of course, social and market ramifications to saying things, and it is not up to me to have to publish any of these people I disagree with. I don't have to do that. I don't have to reward their business. I don't have to do any of those things. But for the social media platforms to determine that they're no longer platforms, as I said earlier, but actual publishers, changes the nature of their role. If they want to be honest about that, then join the club. But if not, then don't pretend you're a platform.
Okay, this will be the last question.
Hey, Ben, thanks for coming out. Appreciate it. You kind of touched on this a little bit, but as a young voter, I'm really concerned about the national debt and entitlement spending. So I was just curious, like, the Republican Party seems really unserious about it, outside of a few senators, unfortunately. But how do you see that playing out, and what would you personally do about it?
I mean, the way that I see it playing out is all of us running headlong off a cliff and then making austerity cuts. Right? I mean, that's the real answer, because nobody is serious about this. The minute that anybody says we need to restructure entitlements, somebody demagogues it. This is true for every entitlement ever created. It's one of the reasons why I'm very skeptical of UBI, because you have folks like Andrew Yang saying, it's $1,000 a month. Well, why can't I just outbid him, right? Why can't I do the Price is Right strategy in that campaign and go, you know what, $1,002 a month? You know, the entitlement programs, as Reagan said, are the only thing that guarantees immortality. They have never-ending life. So I think that cutting that is going to be extraordinarily difficult until the American public are forced to get serious by the fact that the budget comes crashing down on top of them, or we stop being able to sell our debt because finally other countries recognize we're never going to pay it back, or anything like that. So, yeah, I'm very skeptical of the American people's ability to rein in their own spending. I think that it's highly unlikely in the near future, and I think the most likely scenario is that things get really bad before we figure this out. Sure. And everybody will sit here and watch me sign a book. So, rumor is that she's a doctor. I really want to thank all of you for coming out tonight. It really does mean the world to me that there are so many people who want to engage with ideas, particularly, you know, can we have just a quick show of hands? Who here happens to be, I know it won't be that many people, but who here happens to be on a Democrat, on the political left? Well, thank you. Big round of applause for you for engaging with ideas that you may not hear all the time. And thank you so much for coming out. It's great to see all of you.